White Sox fans, welcome in to Season 6, Episode 7 of Sox on Tap. It's Johnny Nani here, alongside my guys Tony on Tap and NWI Steve. Full crew today. It's a three-way show, Steve. I know you enjoy those.
As we like to say in the business, usually you got to pay double for that kind of action.
Tony, how you doing, man?
Hanging in there. Trying to, at least. How about you?
I'm all right. It was an off day today, so that was okay until we got our usual rage bait that came out. But despite the White Sox anemic record, I've been able to kind of sit back, and at least they left me with a good taste yesterday, winning the second game of that doubleheader. So I definitely feel better because of that. But we've got a lot to get into, guys. It's been rough sledding. 2-7 since we last talked here. They're 3-15 overall, worst team in the league. So we'll dissect the good, the bad, the ugly, and get on some other this and that notes involving your Chicago White Sox. Before we do any of that, make sure you subscribe on Tap Sportsnet on YouTube. Give us a follow on the socials at Sox on Tap and at On Tap Sportsnet. And you know, OnTapSportsnet.com is the place to go for all your Chicago sports, literature, and podcasting needs. Guys, let's lead it off with that. We're the worst team in baseball. How does that make you feel?
Not great, Bob. I think is probably the first thing that comes to mind. Not surprised, really, that we're the worst team in baseball. If you've watched this team play at all, not surprised. But it doesn't make me feel proud. I can say that. Not proud about it.
Likewise, it is a very dire situation here. You know, just looking at how this thing has started, I know I didn't anticipate this thing being good. I didn't think it was going to be this bad, though. So we're in some rarefied air right now, and I don't like it.
Well, I'm feeling a little bit apathetic, and I think a lot of that is because the games are very low scoring, at least on our part. Not a lot of runs scored. We'll get into some of the offensive struggles in a bit. But it's one thing, like, I remember that second game of the season. Like, if we were going to lose games like 6-7, Luis Robert hitting a couple home runs and you get random shots from what Paul DeJong, whatnot, that's like one thing. And there's at least a little bit something to get excited about. Fireworks for you, Tony, you know, stuff like that. So I'm just feeling a little bit apathetic about it because it's like, oh, well, I feel like I've already read the script 6, 7, 8 times this year, and we're still in mid-April here. So that's how I'm feeling about it. But guys, it's bad, the overall results, I don't think anyone is shocked in terms of nobody thought this team was going to be good. So that at least we can get out of the way. And we can talk about a couple of recent happenings that were actually positive. Steve, as your username goes down there, I want to dive into the MLB debuts of Nick Nastrini and Jonathan Cannon, who started back-to-back in the series against Kansas City.
So, you know, a couple of things here. You talk a little bit about just the quality of play to this point and the losses in general. Those two losses, the first two games of the series against Kansas City, while they were annoying, yes, they were, I would say, more palatable than a lot of the losses that we have seen to this point. It was just a function of not scoring enough runs, which has been a problem that has plagued them all year, and it's going to continue to plague them all year. But seeing two guys come up in Nick Nastrini and Jonathan Cannon, this is something that I Twittered about. These are two guys that matter. I think there's a lot of people right now that don't understand what they're watching and don't understand what is really important with this team. Seeing these two guys come up, that could be two potential pieces of a long-term starting rotation here. This is important. And you saw positive things from each one of them. Nastrini, I would say, probably has, you know, a little bit more notoriety to him being the guy that was the centerpiece in the deal that sent Lance Lynn to the Doyers last July. And he's, you know, one of the top rated prospects within the Sox system here. And so seeing him come up there, and he did a nice job. Some of the things that I've highlighted with him is just the fact that at times control does get a little bit away from him. We saw that in that fifth inning in his start on Monday when he had a couple of the walks right there. But overall, you can see some of the stuff right there. You can see that there is a plus changeup with him. And everybody knows I love good changeup porn. And that was on full display with him and with Jonathan Cannon yesterday in game one. So there was a lot of positive takeaways from Nick Nastrini there. And I think some things to build upon as it relates to Jonathan Cannon. I know I was waxing poetic on the X machine yesterday after his start. And just, I was impressed so much by what I saw from him, from his demeanor and from his overall mindset and approach from the time he stepped on that rubber. People are sick of hearing me beat this point into the ground here, but mindset matters when you're on the mound. And he went out there and he acted like a guy that was a 10-year veteran, not somebody that was making his first major league start. He had the ball, and from that very first pitch, you could just see it in his face, and he had the mentality of, I'm better than you. I'm going to get you out. I don't care who you are. Sal Perez, you've been in this league for 13, 14 years. I don't give a shit. I'm going to take the ball and I'm going to shove it up your ass. And that's what I want to see from starting pitchers. And then everything he was throwing was moving and it was just hellacious. And he was commanding the strike zone consistently. And like I said, just being aggressive. And we saw that from both of those guys. So very encouraged by the initial debuts for both of them.
Yeah, a lot of ground balls with that sinker, too, from Jonathan Cannon, who you were just talking about. And, Tony, you had texted me something about Nick Nastrini. Share that with the listeners here.
I thought I was texting you about Cannon.
Both of them have it, if I'm not mistaken.
The changeup is absolutely nasty. I didn't get the opportunity to watch the Nastrini start, but the Cannon start, I think I talked to both of you guys about it. I loved the approach. I loved the changeup. The fact that, that second inning, where Fletcher slips and falls in center field. I thought this team was going to unravel. We've seen them unravel plenty of times, and eventually they sort of did here. But Cannon was composed on the mound, and Steve mentioned that just a minute ago here. I like that composure. It's totally different than what you're used to seeing with some of the last core of Sox pitchers, especially in Lucas Giolito, somebody that's been ragged on in our group chat over and over again. That was the complete opposite of that. There was no sulking. There was no tantruming on the mound. He just worked right through that, went after the next hitter, obviously gives up a hit. But, and Steve, you mentioned this right back to me as well when we were talking about it in real time. He still went after the next guy. It wasn't pitching scared. So I think that composure, and Steve said it best, he looked like a 10-year vet out there. And that's really encouraging stuff from a guy coming up here in his first big league start.
Right. I think you guys make great points. I would just point to stuff itself because this is first go around for these guys. First time you're seeing it on a non-grainy highlight video, right? From down in Charlotte or Birmingham or wherever, or whatever their past affiliates were in terms of Nastrini. But the changeup for Nastrini, man, that thing, when they say plus, man, that has some, movement on it. And that is what's really deceptive because obviously you got to have the arm slot. You've got to have the same release point. You've got to tunnel it, right? But when you get that thing just absolutely dying out of the zone to a left-handed hitter, that's devastating. I mean, they look so bad when it's, it finishes 6-7 inches off the plate, but it looked like a strike on the outside corner coming in. So that can be just a devastating pitch. You just got to look at it with the fastball, though. You saw it past Contino put that baby way out to right. That was dead center, though. Middle fastball to him. Can't be doing that. But once again, first start, MLB debut. Still a lot to like from him. And then Cannon, I think you guys hit it on the head. And I liked how Nastrini described Cannon because I had asked him about it on the broadcast. And he had said he's a bulldog. Well, he went to Georgia, so he's a bulldog. And he's got a bulldog mentality. And Steve, I think you summed that up really well in your opening on him.
Yeah, and there was one other point that one of my followers on the X Machine brought up as it relates to Cannon. Again, as I was talking about, Nastrini and Cannon being two guys under, Brian Bannister being of critical importance and the overall change in the pitching philosophy. And follower Mansu Lee, former White Sox legendary bullpen coach there, pointed out to me that, with Cannon being a guy that was drafted and developed solely by the Sox, the first player out of that 2022 draft class to reach the major leagues, that is, I think, particularly encouraging because, Nastrini came from the Dodgers. He was in their development system here. But to have somebody that has only spent time in the White Sox organization come up and hopefully he can continue to make an impact, I think that would go a long way to quelling some of the concerns that a lot of people within the fan base have right now about the player development and the problems that have plagued them for a long period of time. Obviously, Chris Getz has been integral in that aspect of it, but that would, I think, go a long way towards getting people, I'd say, more confident in Bannister and some of the overall changes organizationally that are happening if Cannon is a guy that can stick.
Steve, you're talking to one of White Sox player development's biggest critics right here. So I agree. That was a great first step, man. I really do. I like it. But what I had texted Tony the other day, it's great. And I'm glad that these guys had successful outings their first go around, but it will just be interesting to see. I don't want to anoint them anything right off the bat, because when the league gains film on you at this level and that's shared around, and how to attack guys, how do they counter adjust to that? That's what I want to see. So that's going to take what, 4 or 5 starts before you really, really start seeing specific dialed in plans of attack being formulated against these guys and shared around the league. So I don't want to rain on the parade though, guys, just from an overall mentality thing, take the off on field performance out of it. These guys talking about their debuts, their families there and stuff. How refreshing is it to have people that want to be here? These guys are legitimately excited to be here, and maybe it's they don't know any better yet. Maybe the White Sox haven't infected them yet, but that was a breath of fresh air to me just because of all the negativity that's been swirling around this team over the better part of the last 2.5 seasons.
I think you're dead on with that, Johnny. It's a different feel. Cannon seemed genuinely excited in his press conference about the opportunity to make it to 35th and Shields. And, you know, I'm not going to say that every single White Sox player on this team wasn't, you know, happy to be here over the past 2 years, but
I think we could also say that there's some that weren't, though.
Yeah, there were some that were not happy here. But, you know, that said, it is a huge breath of fresh air for Sox fans and just watching this team play. Man, Sox side Mike. We need that kind of energy from these kids, and I agree with that statement. Steve, you got anything on it?
Yeah, I think it would, again, kind of go a long way towards, you know, helping the mindset of the fan base. If you actually have guys on this team that are likable for the last couple of 2-3 years here, this has been a very unlikable bunch. You can go up and down the roster. You know, obviously coaching staff and managers, obviously right now with Mr. Clean, you know, going up to the front office, there was just so many unlikable personalities surrounding this organization here. So getting some new fresh blood in here and some guys that have, you know, a positive outlook and guys that hopefully can perform to the point where the fan base can get behind them and support them in a way, because, you know, we're seeing a lot of things already making their way around the interwebs about how nobody cares about this team, how this fan base is checked out. But they haven't given us a lot of things to like since May of 2022. So to see that kind of flip itself around and have some positive forces on this team and some guys that you can just get behind every couple of days, whether it's position players or some of the starting pitchers here, that's sorely needed right now.
Yep. Question for you guys though. Can they stay out of their own way? The White Sox from robbing us of that sort of joy.
That's what we're going to find out here. And that's what Mr. Bannisterbot is really hoping and, you know, putting a lot of stock into one Brian Bannister there. But I think that's going to be a big factor in it, in how they handle things. And, you know, it's also while nobody was, I would say, thrilled about Chris Getz, it's also his first go in the big chair, right? So this is going to be a telling season in terms of, okay, well, we have these new guys that are at least a positive presence at the start. How long does that last? Hopefully the entirety of their time here on the South side. That's the hope. That's what every organization hopes all the time, but things happen. Shit happens. It's life, right? Both on field, off field, what have you, injuries, all of that. So weathering all of that, how those guys maintain their attitude through it, and then also how the organization supports them through it. If there's going to be a long-term injury at some point down the road, say, I hate to bring this on, but say there's an arm injury that requires a certain surgery for one of these guys down the road. Will Chris Getz go out and get the pieces that are needed to supplement and get them through that stretch there? If not, then it feels like the weight of the world's on their elbow again, right? So that's, we're in the very infancy stages of this, but the hope is that it can turn around. I don't know if no one's going to be sold on it. I don't think it's even going to happen after one season, but the groundwork has to be laid here.
Yeah. There's so much skepticism right now with everything kind of surrounding a quote unquote plan from Chris Getz, if you even want to call it that it is going to take a long period of time for people, even ardent supporters like us, to really buy in and have a modicum of belief in the direction of this organization right now. You know, I was having a conversation with my uncle earlier today, and for probably a good half hour or so. And, you know, he's, you know, 74 years old, and he doesn't have a very good feeling about the state of this organization right now. And just trying to say, hey, you know, there's a couple little things here to kind of watch that maybe could be building blocks here.
But you giving out, you know, positives and silver linings to look for to your uncle is like the sweetest thing I think in the world.
The Bannister bot is going to start dropping replies in, like, you know, like the thought bots, right? That you see in there. We're gonna
positivity in bio.
Yeah, yeah. New pictures in bio.
exit velocity against in bio.
Yeah. Steve's spreading that now. It's a whole new page here. New year, new Steve.
It's incredible. The transformation that we've witnessed is absolutely incredible.
Yeah. All right. Before we get too far off the rails, while we're still on the pitching front here, I wanted to get take on Eric Fetty, because now we have seen a couple of go-throughs, the rotation with him. And he had his best outing against Kansas City Royals and got himself his first win in a White Sox uniform. I know a lot of people discredit win-loss record for pitchers, rightfully so. I understand it all, but it's still a benchmark sort of to reach there, especially when you join a new club. And I was surprised with even getting up to 5 strikeouts, because I never really viewed him as a swing and miss guy. Thought there's gonna be a lot of pitch to contact, because that's what it's like in the KBO. I was pleasantly surprised with some of the stuff that we saw in his most recent outings. How about you guys?
I think from my perspective, you know, going back and watching that, there were certain positive aspects that you can take. And, you know, this is, I think, one of the biggest differences between him and Mike Soroka, where I think Soroka's stuff has been extremely flat to start the year. Fetty, you can see some building blocks, and you can see some things with him that he does have a lot of movement on his breaking stuff and his sinker. So there's, you know, some things that you can take, say, okay, this can grow and this can develop. And in my preseason prediction article, I kind of talked about him as being a guy that I could almost see maybe having some inconsistencies or even struggling in the first half, and then maybe by the second half, turning a corner a little bit. So you can see some things there with him a little bit. Still not commanding the strike zone particularly well, running a lot of deep counts. I mean, that's why he was, you know, couldn't even get through the 6th inning mark at, you know, below 94 pitches right there. So, you know, still a lot of 2-0, 2-1, 3-1 counts for my liking here. So hopefully that is something that can turn around here. But it definitely was a much more positive outing, a lot of soft contact in there. So hopefully something he can build on going towards his next start.
Yep. And this, you know, I know all the focus is on the prospects, right? The arms that we had just talked about, the Nastrinis, Cannons in the starting rotation, then it'll be the Leisures in the bullpen, right? But this is also a Bannister project, right? This is the first time to kind of reclaim a veteran arm. I know it's a unique situation with the KBO break in between MLB stints there, Steve, but I think if you can get him right, that is a big check mark in your corner there.
100%. And that's, you know, again, I think what Bannister has been successful with at various stops in his career. You look at guys like Rich Hill. You even look at Carlos Rodon to an extent during his short time in San Francisco. Obviously, he did have the good 2021 season with the Sox here. But then going to the Giants there, working with Bannister and the rest of the Giants crew, he built upon that. Kevin Gausman, another guy that when he got to the Giants, really kind of turned his career around. So if maybe they could have that level of success. I'm not saying he's going to turn him into, you know, Kevin Gausman, Cy Young level right there, but just get him to be a serviceable piece of a rotation. That's a win.
I think that's what we're sort of seeing from him right now, is a serviceable piece in the rotation. I mean, I know you probably want him to get into the 6th inning, Steven, as we all do. I'm not looking at his game logs from last year. He's still hovering 96 is the high on the year. He was at 94 on that game against Kansas City yesterday. But I mean, for everything that I'm looking at here and all these game logs, there's nothing that jumps out that this guy's getting shelled, which is what we want to avoid. And you know, this checks out for me at this point. I don't know about you guys, but
yep. Just limit some free passes a little bit. work ahead a little bit more.
Not as worried about him as some other names in the rotation. And if you have guys like Cannon and Nastrini that are going to come in here and solidify some of those spots that looked really horrid coming into the year, I think that's a positive point for the team.
My counter to that would be just, you know, the previous start against Cleveland giving up the 3 home run balls. Anytime you have a sinker ball pitcher giving up multiple home runs in a start, especially against a team like the Indians, that's not particularly encouraging from my perspective here. But, you know, they were able to make some nice adjustments here in this outing against Kansas City. So, again, hopefully just something they can build on.
Right, and it's not the same Kansas City Royals of the past. This Kansas City team has actually been putting runs up over the early portion of the season. So I think that's important to note as well. Because in the past, it would kind of be like, okay, well, that was a get-right game anyway, right? That's not the case, at least so far, 3 weeks into the season, right? So that'll about do it, wrap it up for pitching front here and what we've seen recently. Unfortunately, we got to turn it back to a little bit negative, but I promise we will return to a positive. That'll be on Tony's front in a matter of a couple minutes here. But anemic offense, guys, this is brutal. 38 runs scored, lowest in MLB. Next closest is the Oakland A's with 56. And, guys, it is. I know there's been injuries, but even with those guys, Luis Robert was in a funk before he got injured, right? Yoan Moncada was he was off to an okay start, but you hadn't really seen the power, right? Eloy Jimenez only had a couple of games before he went on the shelf, so you can't really blame it on that. The only guy that's going is Gavin Sheets, and we will let his father take his victory lap here in a minute. But man, this is where I got to when I was telling you guys, just feeling a little apathetic, because it's just not exciting when you don't score runs. I don't know, but I like scoring, because you got to score more than the other team to win the game. If you're not scoring a lot, that means you're not winning a lot. So you do the math there.
I think from my standpoint, this is one of the things that I really harped on in the offseason when you look at some of the, you know, prognostication that people were making about records, and, you know, you look at the preseason, you know, win totals at the various sports books. Everybody knows I'm a big better guy. You know, and you see the various books out there.
Bet on Bannister.
Yeah. You see in a lot of the lines at 66.5, 67.5 wins, when you subtract and when they didn't do anything really to improve an offense that was bottom five in just about every statistical category a year ago, it made no sense to me where they thought that these additional 5 to 6 wins were going to come from. And in fact, in a lot of cases, you could make an argument that they got worse at various offensive positions here. I know they're definitely worse at catcher, which, as bad as Yasmani Grandal was a year ago, that's really saying something right there. And, you know, you take out, you know, MVP caliber Luis Robert for, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. That's certainly not going to help things right there. At the end of the day, there's not a consistent offensive approach. There's not an offensive identity here. This is not a team that hits for power. This is not a team that works counts and takes walks. That's not a good recipe for success to score runs in the game of baseball during the year of our Lord 2024. So until they kind of clean those things up from an organizational standpoint, and look, a lot of these guys that Chris Getz brought in, they are placeholders, admittedly, but they're not guys that have the skill set that is going to translate to a lot of offensive production, unfortunately.
I mean, let's not sugarcoat the fact that this team had trouble scoring runs last year, particularly with runners in scoring position. There was a lot of stale baseball being played offensively. And yeah, we did remove some higher name talent for more of a defensive and pitching approach. And Chris Getz has been very outspoken about doing that. But I agree with you, Johnny. It's boring to watch. I was on here talking about how I just want a 3.5 hour White Sox game where we score runs and it's fun again, because they are arguably the most boring baseball team to watch, if not the most boring baseball team to watch, I think, in Major League Baseball right now, with the combination of just no offense. There's also been some shoddy defense. And I mean, some of those Chris Flexen starts, I don't know about you boys, but it's high time to click and change the channel. So I mean, I just don't know what other word to describe this than anemic, Johnny. It's bad. It is really fucking bad.
Now, I know that there are a couple of guys, and we'll get to one that has been a bright spot here. I'll let you have the floor for that, Tony. But I'm waiting for the Dominic Fletchers to come through in a big spot. And I know he did once, but out in Cleveland, but it can't be a once a week thing, right? I need to see this more consistently. And it needs to come from other sources too. I mean, I know he's not supposed to hit. He's brought in for defense, but Nicky Lopez feels like he barely even gets on base, right? He should at least be doing that at some points. Whereas one of those defensive guys brought in, Paul DeJong, he's actually tied for the team lead in home runs. So I'll give credit to him. He doesn't hit for a high average. Not that that's the most important thing in the world, but
I thought it was the most ridiculous thing, Johnny, when Schifrin said, you know, don't worry, White Sox fans, you have Paul DeJong coming up in the ninth. And that actually proved to be like a potential good thing that he was up in the ninth inning. Like,
well,
we're living in.
He is smacking a few dingers, and a few of them have been pretty clutch. There's that pinch hit one against Atlanta in one of the wins, right? I know he got us on the board up ahead in that game, set us up in game one of the doubleheader. So they have been a little bit timely from Paul DeJong there. That is a little bit surprising, but it's basically like home run or strikeout for him. So we'll leave it at that. There's a lot of guys struggling. I don't know if Andrew Vaughn's just a click away, like Pedro Grifol likes to say in his usual word salad, post-game commentary. I don't buy it. I think Andrew Vaughn is probably – I'm in the cooked camp.
Can I have a couple? Can I have
give Steve the floor here.
Can I have like 90 seconds on this here? This whole Andrew Vaughn thing. Look, I was saying this, last year. I know there were people that were saying it before me, but this is not – what we were told he was going to be. We were told he was going to be a masher. People said that he was the best collegiate hitter since Chris Bryant, and he has not lived up to that. This is a guy that has never had a slug higher than 429 in a season for a right first baseman. That's not good enough. Remember, they said getting him off the grass was going to all of a sudden turn him into a 35 home run a year slugger. It's not fucking happening. If anything, the progress is going backwards in a number of ways. And this thing about him being a click away, I'm sorry, I am not seeing it. And, I know Anthony's going to get to, the conversation about his baby boy here. But at the end of the day, as long as Gavin is going out there having quality at bats, which he has been doing consistently here for about the last 2 weeks, he's been hitting the ball out of the ballpark. He's been taking walks. Even when he's making outs, he's having quality at bats, taking pitches, getting deeper into counts. There's no reason that Gavin Sheets should be sitting, unless it's a left-handed starting pitcher on the mound, in favor of Andrew Vaughn at this point. And I talked about this over the offseason, and I'm going to stand by this right now. Andrew Vaughn is trending closer and closer with each passing day towards non-tender this winter.
Yeah, right. And you know what the sad thing is, with the trajectory that he's on, there's going to be a lot of DFA calls during the season. I don't see that happening, but I'm just saying it's going to happen because the offensive struggles will continue with this team. All right. We've ran roughshod through the negative here. It's Tony's time. Your son, Gavin Sheets, is the only legitimate positive offensive presence on this team. I think he's seeing the ball really well. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing the same thing that you guys are. Steve mentioned it, quality at bats. And this is something that I liked from Gavin early on in his career, was he just seemed to have a different plate approach than most of the guys on this White Sox team, and going back 2 years here, had. I mean, it was sort of almost what you wanted Yasmani Grandal to do a little bit more of. That's what I sort of initially saw in Gavin. Yes, last year was bad. It was horrendous offensively. I don't know what exactly changed this year, but it seems that he's making a little bit more contact alongside that good plate approach. And that's really translated somehow, some way. The baseball gods have not put the White Sox curse on his bat this year. It just seems a little bit different. I don't know if it's the combination of just maturity and the same work that he's put in, because not a lot looks completely different in Gavin's game. The results are just happening. That's what I'm seeing right now. These plate appearances are looking the exact same that he had last season. He's getting a little bit more opportunity because he's been hot, and he's just continued to do that. And that's what we've wanted. I mean, let's go back a week ago and people were asking me if you should pick this guy up in fantasy baseball. And I'm saying, I don't know. I don't believe that this can, you know, continue. This might just be a little stretch. I'm still hesitant to say that he's going to finish the season as well as he started it. But for any White Sox player on this roster right now, offensively, he's the guy that you want to watch taking at bat. I don't really have any other name on here. Maybe Paul Young. But as Steve said, unless it's a left-handed pitcher, I think he still hasn't gotten a hit off of a lefty this season. He's just mashing righties right now, guys. And it's fun to watch. What are we at? 3 home runs so far this season. The batting average has come down a little bit. I believe it was up near 270, in the 270s, near 280 a couple of days ago. He's sitting at 250 right now. OBP 370, slugging 545. Steve, I don't have Andrew Vaughn's numbers in front of me, but is this better?
Hashtag confirmed better.
Okay. So, I mean, I never thought that we'd have the opportunity to sit here and do this because Gavin got a lot of slander out there last season. There was a lot of calls for DFA for him. It's really interesting to be sitting right here thinking that he is your top offensive guy. I always liked him as a guy coming off of the bench in a spot where you needed power against a righty late in ball games, but he's really jumped out this season and taken a hold of his career almost in a lot of different ways. So it's impressive to see. I want to see it continue before I'm ready to hand out any accolades. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done, I think, with Gavin Sheets offensively. But as of right now, you know, he's sitting tied with this 2021 season in right around 250, 370. The OBP is up well over anything he's done for an extended stretch. And that's because he's also taken a lot of walks. He's at 7 so far in the season. Steve, I know you love players that can draw walks. I think
only behind Robbie Grossman, right? With 9.
I think he beats his career high this year because that sits at 28 from last season pretty handedly.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I really would love somebody that has access to this team on a day in and day out basis to find out from Gavin is, you know, what work did you put in over the course of the winter to lead to some of these substantive changes in the early part of the season here with the improved walk rate and plate selectivity here. You know, what video is he watching? What work was done to kind of get to that point where you're having those quality at bats? And I've talked about this a lot, and I think there's, again, a great misnomer that goes around within the fan base about, you know, guys not being valuable because they don't walk. I think walks are a byproduct of having a good approach. I like when guys are able to command the strike zone and get themselves into hitters counts so that they can do damage on the baseball. When Tim Anderson was at his best, he still wasn't walking at higher than a 4% clip, but you fall behind him 2-0, 3-1, and he can sit dead red on that fastball. He's hitting a double, you know, the other way to hashtag set the tone or hitting the ball out of the ballpark. And that's what Gavin is doing right now. He's putting himself in a position to be dangerous. He's taking those pitches that are out of the zone and then getting himself into those quality hitters counts where he can look one pitch, one zone, and really let it fly out there. And that's what you want to see from a guy in the middle part of your order right now. And so again, what changes, what things did he do over the course of the winter to put himself in the position to do this? I want to know this stuff, and so I don't know why nobody's asking that.
I don't have a full answer for you, but in terms of his personal approach, if I remember correctly, there was a spring training tidbit back in like the end of February, but they'd asked him about what was different, and he said he was trying to tweak too much mechanically from at-bat to at-bat, game to game last year, whereas this offseason, he was able to iron that out and not worry about that, so maybe a greater focus, it was a lot to the pitch selection, but I'd be interested too as well. What kind of drills, Steve? I know we kind of heard early in the season, you know, I think it was James Fegan had mentioned something about Luis Robert and pitch selection drills or video, you know, technology that he had used in the offseason that looked good for a little bit. And then he got into the slump there. So it was how effective was that. But that was just the only insight that I could share. It was ironing out the mechanics fully and not banking on that to be his savior. Seemed like he was trying to save his season every at bat on a, you know, game to game basis last year. So
there was a little more pressure on him though.
Right.
I mean, that could, you know, also play into it a little bit here. There's a little more opportunity for him on this roster than I think last year's roster or the year prior to that. I mean, there's a reason why he's been pushed into right field as well. And we talked about that for years when it came to the Rickon roster construction.
All right. This has been like a positive negative sandwich. And unfortunately, we have to go back to the negative here because this guy has just, he has a negative OPS plus. Let's just say it like it is. And he's defensive metrics are not good either. Martin Maldonado is hashtag cooked, folks. We're declaring it now. This is horrid signing from the beginning. I can't stand him. It's an automatic out. When he comes up to the plate, and you're honestly lucky if you can get a situation where it's a bunt, so his out can at least move a runner forward. And I don't like bunting much as the next person, but that's where we're at with this guy. And he is giving away pitches that should be strikes for his guys due to his decline in framing. This is not 2018, 2017 Martin Maldonado on the Astros anymore. Folks, it's horrid. And man, there is nothing he's doing to make any value for this team right now. I don't want to hear it anymore from the broadcast on the solid veteran presence behind the plate and stabilizing and going out in the mound visit. Maybe once a week that might do something somewhat positive. You can't quantify it. And you at that point, you'd rather just have Corey Lee saving you the strikes on pitches that Martin Maldonado would get called balls. I need to rant on that, guys. I'm so sick of seeing him every single time he comes up to the plate or squats down behind the plate. It's horrid.
Yeah, it's been terrible on all fronts. You know, I talked about this after the game against Atlanta. You know, when Garrett Crochet threw the gem that he did, and you know, I talked about the mound visit that Maldonado made in the fifth inning with two runners on and number nine hitter coming up in Ronald Acuna at, you know, in the on deck circle, and you know, maybe Maldonado going out there and helping him to kind of reset and refocus a little bit, you know. So I sung his praises for that. I sung his praises for it. So now I got to take him to task for the same thing in the first game yesterday. You know, in that eighth inning, Royals get a runner on, and Sal Perez comes up to the plate. The most dangerous power bat, I mean, arguably one or 1A as far as most dangerous power bat in the Royals lineup. A guy that is a notorious dead red fastball hitter. We know Michael Kopech is about 80% fastballs, okay? So Maldonado goes out to the mound. I can't for the life of me understand what the thought process is behind going out there, having a conversation with him about the number four hitter in the lineup here, a guy that just swings at every fastball around, and then putting that one down for that very first pitch. And then next thing you know, it's a 3-2 game. So I talked positively about it. That was absolute dog shit. If you're going to make a decision like that when you aren't blocking well, you're not receiving, you're not framing, you're not throwing runners out, what the fuck are you doing out there? Because that's your existence, is being a guy that can call a good game for young pitchers, and then you put that one down with Sal Perez at the plate? Give me a fucking break.
Yep. And I was so happy to see Corey Lee gun the guy down in the eighth inning of game two. I'm just hoping that seeing that in a crucial situation will catch the eye of this coaching staff, say, oh, this guy should be playing more. And I never thought I'd be pounding the table here for Corey Lee, but he's off to an okay start to the season. I'd like a little more from the bat. I think we'd like a little bit more from all of the bats in this lineup, but it's gotten to the point where Maldonado is just such a liability and offers no value on either side of it. So here I am pounding the table for Corey Lee. But sorry, I didn't want to cut you off, Tony, but that's where
You're good, dude. I'm thinking the same thing right here from where I'm sitting. I didn't think we'd be at a point ever where Corey Lee was our best option at catcher right now, that the people want to see. The only thing I can make sense of, Steve, was that Michael Kopech missed his spot bad in that pitch because it was over the middle.
I mean, he obviously missed the spot bad too, but again, with Sal Perez being a guy that just sits dead red on fastballs,
yeah,
the likelihood of Sal Perez
chasing so much.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. The likelihood, I mean, it's very rare for him to not swing at a pitch that makes it out on a fly 60 feet, 6 inches. So, you know, you can talk about missing the spot all you want. The probability of him taking 4 sliders out of the strike zone and walking to first base is so minimal. I just can't excuse that.
Well, tinfoil hat time. Was Martin Maldonado scared that he might have to move over and block a ball if it was called a slider? That's where I'm.
My God, that's really interesting.
The knees aren't going to let me get there anymore, boys. That's fastball, dead red.
He might have to get the Jake Taylor treatment from Major League 2 at this point.
I've seen it with Kopech though, man. He relies on that fastball. And you said it was 80%. I think I was looking at it last year, and we've slowly watched a lot of the other pitches evaporate from his arsenal. Wasn't he supposed to be working on a changeup at some point?
He is, but I mean, look, when you're in the position where you're just coming in to be a back inning reliever, you can get by with two pitches.
Was the changeup stuff when he was still technically in the rotation?
Yeah. I mean, if you are a back end guy, you know, in the late innings, and if you're there to attack leverage, as Mr. Clean would say,
we tackle leverage. We tackle leverage.
You know, you can get by with the two pitches there. But again, I can't excuse throwing a first pitch fastball in that situation.
Yep. Well, that was an unfortunate scenario between Maldonado and Kopech there in game one. But in game two, like I said, I gave the credit to Corey Lee. Shout out to Davey Garcia. I was down on him. He had a couple of rough outings, but he got that thing back on track and closed that thing out for the Sox in game two. But I was very happy. And there was very little. I know he had a two-out walk and then a two-out single in the ninth, and there was that fly ball to center field, but there was no, like, heart-stopping bases traffic, really, with Davey Garcia. So shout-out to him for getting it right. That was a good bounce back to see from Mr. Garcia. All right, guys, on to a little bit of this and that. And, you know, we can't go a 24-hour period in this fandom without a existential crisis about something. And Tuesdays, even though we didn't play because it got banged, the game got rained out, rescheduled for that doubleheader on Wednesday, we had the James Fegan posting the picture of the White Sox, you know, pregame program that included the lineup and what they were doing, what times they were warming up and whatnot. And people lost their minds when they saw the word optional next to stretch. And this thing got, you know, a lot of traction on the interwebs, even though Fegan did send a follow-up to that and saying, I can't tell you how, you know, not uncommon it is to see this optional for these types of things for a major league team. It just happened to get out there. And of course, people are going to run rampant with it, given this team's recent injury history. Guys, it was pretty wild to see. And I know a lot of people aren't going to buy Pedro's explanation. But on this one, I'm in the camp of you can't freak out about everything, because I guarantee if you saw every team's sheet from every day across the league, you'd be seeing a lot of things similar. I'm not in a clubhouse. I'm not in there every day, but I can guarantee it. If you're getting this sort of information from credentialed media members and then listening to the program that Pedro had outlined in their full team workout on a certain day, and then the next day everybody showed up when it was optional anyway, and then okay, you got to have a break in there somewhere. You're going to get injured from being overworked instead of, you know, not being lucid enough with your stretching there. So I thought this was just a complete debacle and it got blown out of proportion. But your guys' thoughts on it there? It was just quite the scene.
To me, it was a giant nothing burger. I think it's just a byproduct of the fact that this team has had so many injuries over the course of the last 3 years, and so much has been called into question between the training staff, between the players on the roster, that they haven't done anything to give themselves the benefit of the doubt. And all this does, unfortunately, is add fuel to the fire to an organization that is in disarray and a, you know, just overall process that is completely lacking. But like you said, Jonathan, I mean, this isn't going to be anything abnormal from what successful teams like my Barves or the Doyers or the Rays or teams like that do. But because it's the White Sox, because of the extensive injury history that has taken place over the course of the last few years, people are going to see that. And again, the cloud of negativity that is just hovering over this team, it just allows people to pounce on it and gives them something to bitch about, because it, you have to have something every day.
Right. Today's is the Tim Anderson comments. We're not even going to dive into that too much, but I'm sure you've seen him over there on the north side because the Marlins are there. And the same thing, I'm not even playing today, but we got, we're not playing today. We're travel day, but got some rage bait today. Tony, any thoughts on this scenario before we move on to something much more enjoyable to talk about?
You know, I think it really just boils down to the fact that the work ethic and the PR spin that we got out of Pedro Grifol last year sort of carries over into this. We're going to prepare every day to kick your ass. And then, you know, these things optional. It's me more of the material. That's really what it boils down to for people.
True.
It's really easy to pick off that and say, all right, well, this guy said he was going to come in here and work on these fundamentals and do all these things. And then, well, now it's optional. I understand the fact that, every single major league team isn't going to be working their guys 24/7. And, you know, as you mentioned, that could lead to overworking guys and cause an injury in and of itself. Just through that, it really, to me, just boils down to the bad PR job that this White Sox team has done. And they haven't helped themselves because they haven't won anything and they are injury plagued. So anytime you see something that's easy for the internet to pick off, it's going to become a story. And anything that becomes a story is just going to drive places to cover it more. And it snowballs from there. They can't get out of their own way when it comes to little things like this. And then you get more national outlets to pile on and make fun of this team. I mean, it's you're low man on the totem pole, and they're going to keep catching shit like this until it turns around.
Right.
As Steve says, the beatings will continue until the morale improves. Yeah.
No, but I agree on that front in terms of the spread, the sprawl of all of that. But I think we all detest the Pedro Grifol word salad, and there's a lot of, I'd say 95% of what he says is usually roll your eyes material. On this one, I actually agree with him. I read his full response, what James Fegan had posted there, and it was, in my opinion, a sufficient breakdown of who operates what at that level of the training staff and who's in charge of what and tracking who's doing what. You might want to rag him for the injury history like Steve had outlined there. There are still people that are professionals doing this. So I will, give it to them. If they say that stretch is optional for that certain day on that time, that's up to them. Guess what? Not every day you're going to see that one. Are you going to wake up every day and wonder what? Oh, was stretch optional today? White Sox didn't get injured in any of the doubleheader games yesterday.
No.
Just FYI. So, just throwing it out there. I just wanted to do that because that was the Tuesday's blow up. So
to me, it's no more than an internet thing. I mean, there's still people that think Corey Perry and Connor Bedard's mom had relations. So
yeah, that's true. You're right. Yep. Gossip travels. All right, let's get on to something much more positive. Big day, White Sox history. Mark Burley, no-hitter anniversary. Steven, take us down memory lane.
I don't know if people know this, but I was there on this night.
Is that confirmed?
It is hashtag confirmed. I have the ticket framed right there on my wall. Centerpiece.
I love me some paper tickets.
So, oh God, I long for them to come back. I would kill for that, honestly. So I was hashtag there. It was a cold April night, and former White Sox legend Samuel Sosa took a leadoff walk in the second inning, and then Mr. Burley promptly picked him off. 27 batters came to the plate, no hitters. No base hits throughout the course of that one. Little soft dribbler to Joe Creedy to end it. And anytime you get an opportunity to see your favorite player on your favorite team do something special like that, it's something that's always going to stick with you. And Mark Burley is my favorite White Sox player of all time. And to say that I was actually in attendance there to watch him throw a no-hitter on that day is it's one of my favorite baseball memories of all time. And this day will always be special to me because of that.
I think Mark Burley, there's others, Frank Thomas, but Mark Burley might be the most beloved widespread White Sox player among at least this sort of generation. The guys that, you know, saw him in his prime. Maybe the newer fans are, you know, not as in tune with the full history of what he really was. But man, the quickness with which he worked, the efficiency. I mean, shit, he would have no problem with the pitch clock because he set the tone on his own, and he knew how quick that game was going to get done. And working efficiently, didn't have to be a huge strikeout guy. He could fan someone when needed. But man, Burley was also one of my favorites. Definitely my favorite pitcher from that time frame.
I've got nothing to add to that, guys. I mean, Mark Burley's Mark Burley, and that he's a legend to all of us and embodied all the spirit of passion, pride, tradition, everything that we love about the White Sox. And
yeah, back when we didn't say it sarcastically.
Yeah, exactly. Back when it was cool and tough.
Right. Well said. All right. Happy anniversary, Mark Burley. We love you. All right. We are getting close to the end here of season 6, episode 7 of the Sox on Tap podcast. We appreciate everyone tuning in and jumping in the comments here. We got to take a look at what's on tap next before we get on out of here. So we're hitting the road, going to Philadelphia. Friday, it'll be Garrett Crochet versus Spencer Turnbull for a 5:40 first pitch. Mike Soroka takes the mound against Zach Wheeler on Saturday, 5:05 first pitch, and Sunday matinee, 12:35 first pitch. Nick Nastrini getting a second start. It'll be Aaron Nola on the bump for the Phillies. Guys, how do we feel going into the City of Brotherly Love?
Not great overall, you know, for being honest here. But, you know, again, I think there are some important things to watch with this. You know, Garrett Crochet going up against a pretty prolific Phillies offense, one that has propensity to hit the ball out of the ballpark. I'm going to be fascinated to see how Crochet rebounds off of the last outing on Saturday against the Cincinnati Reds. One of the things I talked about was he was behind in counts too frequently in that outing. Too many.
Didn't he still strike out 10?
He did. He did. That's
weird. Yeah.
But, you know, again, like
the second inning was all it took, right?
Yeah. And that's kind of, that was kind of like a Dylan Cease outing right there. You know, you have the high strikeout numbers, but too many 2-0, 2-1, 3-1 counts. And that is ultimately what got him into trouble. And against a team like the Phillies, you can't afford to do that. So hopefully I want to see him get back to what he did his first three outings, working ahead in counts consistently, using both sides of the plate, up, down, in, out. You know, kind of let's get back to that a little bit. And then seeing Nick Nastrini and how he follows up from his debut. So there's important things to watch here in these two games. I'm not optimistic about how the team is going to fare over the course of the weekend here, but I know what I'm looking for when I'm sitting down watching these games.
We looking at a little bit of extended rest for Crochet here?
I think that we're probably going to start to see him, or not necessarily start to see him, but I think over the course of the year, we are going to see them use and manipulate the schedule a little bit, right, to give him an extra day. Yeah, you use the off day, maybe skip him a time in the rotation. And I think it's even going to be interesting then once Mike Clevinger is ready to join the rotation here. You know, is it possible that maybe they have periods of time where they go maybe to a six-man rotation in there? So they are definitely going to have to try to manage his innings and manage his workload here as the season progresses here. So I think we definitely will see that as we move along.
Right. There's got to be some sort of innings cap, not publicly available, but I'm just interested to know what it actually is. I'd like to know that. I don't think they're ever going to reveal that, but how they manage some of this down the stretch is just something that I think we'll all be keeping a keen eye on, because you want to see Garrett Crochet essentially strong every time he goes out, and you don't want to see him have to flutter, you know, fizzle out and get shut down at the end of the year. Sure, if he needed to do it maybe last couple weeks, that'd be okay, but you don't want to see it happen in August, right? So that's one thing
I think we could definitely see with it, and depending how the rotation, you know, plays out, maybe if they set it up where that series going into, you know, that last series heading into the All-Star break, maybe he throws on, you know, a Friday, and then you've got All-Star week. So, you know, he'll have some full time right there. And then maybe they have him slotted for the fourth or fifth game back off of the All-Star break. So you could almost give him a 2-week breather in the middle part of the season right there. So things like that, I wouldn't be surprised to see.
Right. For sure. All right. Last question on this series. I'm gonna stop just asking for record predictions. Do you think we at least salvage one? That's where we're at.
Definitely not Saturday. Definitely not Saturday. The Soroka Wheeler matchup is very intriguing to me.
So there's one L. You win crochet day.
I don't like the odds.
Not enough offense.
Yeah, probably I just don't think
he could throw well, but even, you know.
It could be like
no slouch on Sunday either. So, right,
yeah. You know, a 2-1 loss on Friday wouldn't surprise me.
Right. I'm going to say no, we don't get a win. It's going to be a sweep.
Haven't we gone like five losses in a row? Got a win.
It was four losses in a row, then five losses in a row, then six. So if we follow trend now, we'd have to lose seven games in a row here. But listen,
I don't like going a week in between posting the victory beers.
Let's talk positive here right now. 2 days in a row, you know, or. Well, not, I guess we can't even technically say 2 days in a row without a loss because they lost game one yesterday. Yep. But damn it. Fuck. There goes that.
There goes your grand idea for manipulating some positivity out of this White Sox team. All right. That'll about do it for this episode of Sox on Tap. We appreciate everybody tuning in. Before we get out of here, make sure you're subscribed over on YouTube. That's at OnTap Sportsnet. And give us a follow on the socials at Sox on Tap and at OnTap Sportsnet. And you know, OnTapSportsNet.com is the place to go for all your Chicago sports literature and podcasting needs. My final thought to close this out. We had a question earlier in the show and it said, is there anything that could happen this season that would make you become a Cubs fan for 2024? Absolutely not. Resounding no on all fronts here. That's all I've got, guys. White Sox forever.
White Sox forever.
White Sox for life.